Monty Python and the Holy Grail is a mainstay of dork cinema. With jokes ranging from intellectually sublime to scatologically infantile, this movie has gags at a rate of 5.7 per minute. You don't even have to get half of them to have a good time watching this one. This is the Pythons at the height of their powers, before creative differences spun names like John Cleese, Eric Idle, and Michael Palin all over the British comedy universe. And speaking of amazing gatherings of geeky talent, this episode comes to you as a rap party on Dork Weekend 9, an infamous nerd hive of scum and villainy. The whole crew couldn't make the show, but we've got a four-person lineup to break down this purported classic of geekery. Be careful mixing up your hand grenades and use three types of alcohol. Four is too many, two isn't enough, and five is right out. It's time for episode 95 of Toasting the Classics, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Welcome to Toasting the Classics, a podcast where we take something that people call a classic and we're going to talk about it and we're going to decide if it's still a classic. And not only that, we're also going to drink something inspired by the classic while we do it. In this case, we have the remnants of a once great gathering, Dork Weekend 9. Not everyone could attend the video session that we did afterwards. It was too much epic role-playing for, what, 3 days?
Too dork, too furious.
Yeah, too dork, too furious. We were going to do a podcast live from Dork Weekend 9, but instead we're doing it a little bit later. And appropriately, what did we choose, gentlemen?
We are going to do Monty Python's Holy Grail.
Has anybody not seen this before? No, right? That's a ridiculous question.
Yeah, we've all seen it.
I mean, I rewatched it for this, but it was probably the 10th rewatch of my life.
So I would suppose that if there's anybody out there in the world listening to this podcast who has not seen this movie, that person is less than 20 years old.
Classic, right? We're done. No.
It's probably closer to 30 years old. Remember, this movie's older than any of us.
Well, but don't you think you would have encountered the movie by the time you went through college and some, you know, like somebody would have said, you know, it seems like you would have come across it in some way. But this was a big part of growing up for me. How long has it been since you guys have seen this?
Easily 20 years for me.
Oh, wow. Wow. Really? Okay. Okay, that's significant. That's almost like watching something again, I think. Like.
Oh, no, it all came back. Like, I've seen this so many times.
I have seen it many times. This is one of the movies, I would say there's about 20 or 30 movies that I had VHS tapes of that were just on rotation playing in my basement room at my parents' house when I was a kid. I would just put them on and like go about my business while they were on. Like
I can probably guess six of them without too much effort, but I don't know if that's useful.
Some of them are pretty obvious. How about Bill and Kevin? How about you guys? Oh, wait, we should say who's here. I'm Dave MacArthur. I'm always here.
I'm Chris Gregg. I'm here sometimes.
Okay. And the other guys?
Kevin Doyle. I'm occasionally here when I'm invited and remember to come.
You've been. I think Bill's probably slightly ahead of you in terms of appearances. In fact, I think I'm going to put together a spreadsheet and show.
Bill has got a few more in on me.
That's probably true. Well, yeah. Bill and I have done some solos, just the two of us. So we have a small suite of episodes about nature related books, I think is kind of the thing that we're doing. So,
and films, I think.
We didn't get the fourth person, did we? We kind of spoke around him. Bill, did you get a chance to intro yourself?
Yeah, Bill Hodges. Again,
you sound underwhelmed by your own existence, Bill.
Some days more so than others.
Nice. Boy, don't I know what that's like. So we're missing two people who were also at Dork Weekend and were supposed to be here, which are Javier Gregson, I believe is his last name. If I'm saying that right. And Paul Goodwin, shout out to you guys. Pour out a little bit of hand grenade for the homies who ain't here on the podcast tonight.
Not on my carpet.
No. Well, not. Don't pour it out. Don't get rid of it. Pour it into a glass and then drink it afterwards. We're not actually sacrificed. They're not dead. They don't actually get, we don't waste alcohol in their name. So
I thought that was what the angel's share was for.
Yeah. Well, that's a Passover thing. So I can tell you, kids, turn off the podcast right now. But when Elijah flies into the house and drinks the wine that we leave on the table, I drink that. I don't waste wine. I don't throw the wine away.
Get back to the like really nerdy roots of the podcast. The angel's share is technically the alcohol that evaporates while it's aging.
So we've kind of teased the drink that we're doing. Does anybody want to talk about what we decided to do? We've got, as it turns out, two different drinks.
Sort of. I think we all have a holy hand grenade, though.
Bill had
a holy hand grenade. A hand grenade. It's not holy.
I had the holy hand grenade. So the holy hand grenade included the chambord. Now, my understanding of the hand grenade is that that's kind of more of a Mardi Gras.
It is not restricted to Mardi Gras. It is restricted to, I would say, Bourbon Street for the most part.
Oh,
there's a place, I think it's called Tropical Isle on Bourbon, that sells big plastic grenade-shaped drinks that have this concoction inside of it. One of the first times I ever went to New Orleans, my friend Sam, who most of you all know, Sam Jensen, drank, I think, two of them, and they had the fully loaded Everclear concoction inside them, and he was not okay for about 24 hours afterwards. It was one of the worst hangovers I've ever seen him. We were driving.
It was Mai Tais, Bill. Remember that? Oh, my God.
My God.
Mai Tais. Where'd you guys have Mai Tais?
I was visiting in San Francisco, and I had
We went to this place that actually was known by Anthony Bourdain, right? Didn't he famously go into this place?
That's why we were there, yeah.
That's actually why he's dead.
Because I went there to this place of his.
It hurt my heart. That's not
too soon, Dave. Too soon.
I hate myself. I laughed at that joke, dude.
Yeah, well, that's what we're here for. We're all here on the podcast to maybe
pour
ruin
a little
our
out for Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, actually, do pour some.
Well, so Bill, it looks to me like you're not drinking a hand grenade. A hand grenade is visibly recognizable as the concoction that it is. So what are you drinking tonight and why?
Well, so, you know, I got all the ingredients to make the holy hand grenade, including the chambord. But then while I was at the store with many different types of alcohol and beers from around the world, I was like, oh, I wonder if they actually have the beer that we had talked about, which is the Black Sheep Brewing Company's Monty Python's Holy Grail. So it's a British style pale ale. So I was able to find that. So I am drinking that on a Sunday instead of drinking a very high sugar and alcohol content beverage because I have to go work with children first thing in the morning.
Yeah, you're the smart one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably. I think discretion is the better part of valor on this one. That sounds wise. But you said the chambord is in a holy hand grenade. Is holy hand grenade different than a hand grenade? Is that a different
thing? That's my understanding. Yes, that's my understanding.
Because I don't know anything about chambord. I don't actually even know. I know that's a liqueur.
It's a raspberry liqueur, yeah. Okay. There are a few different varieties, but chambord is the French raspberry liqueur.
Sounds tasty.
Framboise? No, that's actually raspberry.
Is it framboise?
Raspberry.
All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and pour. I made it up in the mixer, and I'm pouring it into a drink. Chris, it looks like you just took your first sip. How are you doing?
For those playing along at home, I believe it should look and taste vaguely like antifreeze.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good old ethylene glycol right there.
I can see how it is dangerous, and I can see how Sam had issues because it goes down way too easy.
We were very inexperienced at having alcohol at the time, too. We were very young, so things went amiss. So what did you put in yours, Chris?
I forego the gin. I used Midori, pineapple juice, vodka, and rum.
Oh, sounds like we've all got slightly different recipes, don't we? Because I didn't put in the Everclear, which was called for in my recipe. That's just not something that needs to happen tonight. But I've got gin, vodka, rum. And then I just used a fruit juice that looks like Midori. I didn't have Midori either, but I think it ended up looking about like what it's supposed to. If you remember Ecto Cooler from Kool-Aid, it's supposed to look pretty much like that and taste just about the same.
As in Mountain Dew. That's
yeah. And, yeah.
I was going to make a Slimer joke. Yeah.
And then it almost turned Sam Jensen into a ghost is what it does. So Kevin, get us started. Let's talk about this film.
We start off with the coconuts, right? I mean,
the psychedelic intro, right?
I mean, even before that with the subtitles where they just kind of
moose.
The moose. I forgot that. I mean, that's pretty much setting the stage, right? For this is going to be silly AF. They're just going to go totally off the wire. They're going to be, it's a way to set the tone for the rest of the movie. And I can't imagine like seeing that for the first time, like in a theater, you know, like where you kind of are expecting, you know, like that must've been 50 years ago. That must've been quite the trip.
Pretty shocking. Yeah. And I don't think a lot of people in the United States would have seen it in the theater. I don't think it had any kind of, not any major theatrical release in the States. But
a quick trivia note, the first time they actually showed the movie to people, the projector broke and they thought it was a part of the gag.
Yeah,
I would. And so the audience was cheering, and somebody had to come and be like, "Oh no, we have a bomb scare! You all have to leave."
Getting us back to England, 932 AD,
which is not the right year for King Arthur.
No, I don't think they're really bothered with accuracy.
No.
Well, right. No, it really just traditionally, is there anything accurate about King Arthur anyway? Like, you know,
that's a whole can of
Charlemagne. Is he like, you know, like what is the reference there with
the version of King Arthur that we all think about when we think about like the musical Camelot and the movies and stuff like that is totally based on Charlemagne to my knowledge. That's there's a lot about Charlemagne. It's like searching for relics and losing on a big battlefield and things like a lot of stuff is mapped directly from Charlemagne's life onto King Arthur. But there is supposedly some kind of a real guy who would have been like not long after the Romans left England,
right?
Like in the 5th century, maybe early 6th century AD. It wouldn't have looked anything like this guy or acted anything like this guy. Maybe would have only been nominally Christian, even.
Right.
Very different situation than what's going on in this film. But yeah, this is based on the medieval thing. And I think to some extent on the musical, right? Isn't a lot of what they're doing in this movie making fun of the musical Camelot, which I don't know if I've ever seen.
I have seen a revival of Camelot, and I'm not sure how much is a direct parody of that and how much is just a mockery of the Arthurian legend in general, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I get more a sense of the latter.
I mean, there's the musicals, there's the send-up of the musical. I remember the part where in the castle and the son gets ready to sing, and the dad's like, "Stop that! Stop that!" Because I remember thinking, "Oh, I wish somebody would do that in musicals." Because when I was a kid, I hated musicals. And when people would start singing, I was just like, "I wish that guy would come in and cease that immediately."
Which is in itself funny because they already had a musical number in this movie.
They did, yeah.
Which was Camelot, right?
Yes.
'Tis a silly place.
Actually, let's not go there.
Yeah. So who knows the different players in the Monty Python troupe?
John Cleese, Eric Idle,
Michael Palin,
yeah.
Graham Chapman.
Graham Chapman plays Arthur in
and,
this
one. Yep. And you've got the Terrys. Yeah, Terry Jones and Terry Gilliam.
That's right. One of those two guys isn't actually in it, right? He did the artwork.
No, they're both appear. In it.
They both appear.
Terry okay.
Gilliam. They both appear it.
Plays the squire.
That's right.
And he plays the Green Knight. There's a Black Knight and there's a Green Knight. The Black Knight kills the Green Knight.
He kills him like before Arthur meets
yeah,
up.
He's
with
standing
him.
There. Yeah, Arthur is there watching this massive fight where they're like somehow exchanging weapons throughout. It's like goes from a broadsword to this giant like mace and chain, and the other guy has a long sword and a hand axe suddenly appears.
And that's the fourth basically skit of the movie. I think of it as being divided into a bunch of different skits.
I think that's yeah. There's some loose connective tissue in the film that brings them together, but it's more or less a series of sketches about Arthurian legend.
Right.
Essentially, like you basically
gathering of the knights. Yes. Right.
Yeah. Well, there's, I guess, yeah. I mean, when people die, they don't come back later in the movie and things like. There is some narrative continuity, I guess, but mostly it's sketches that are loosely connected.
Yes.
Well, and they were struggling with that as the Pythons. You know, this was really the first movie where they had the final cut. There was now for something completely different. But they had far less actual control over how that film was rolled out. Mm-hmm. And so this was really the first time that they got to do this. And one of the big critiques of that previous one of Now for Something Completely Different, the wanted to have something more cohesive, but we're coming from this place of course, doing all of the sketch comedy.
Right.
I heard that this was very tightly scripted. Like it appears like it's a lot of it's ad-libbed and a lot of it is kind of figured out on the fly. But apparently, like once the script was written, they stuck to it and it was, you know, they acted to it and there was really very little ad-libbing once things were figured out. Don't quote me on that, but I do think that was you know, kind of their routine in general. To they wrote everything out.
It seems like they gave like individual writers on the in the group, like would write a scene and then they would fit it into the movie somehow. And you know, and it, somebody was doing a job of stitching everything together into a story. Right. But mostly, it was wouldn't it be funny if he fights this guy and the guy doesn't die when he gets his arm cut off and won't stop fighting? And you know,
the mechanism though too to kind of accommodate that was, you know, there were knights that could put on these helmets. Some other actor could step in while the actor that was originally, like, say, you know, what John Cleese was playing with Sir Lancelot, he could play, you know, Tim the Enchanter and still be, you know, have that stand in because he put on a helmet and he'd have that version of him. And it was really cool. They had to figure all that out and how they kind of made all that happen to so that they could all be in it, all kind of take their scene that they kind of wrote or they kind of were given, you know, whatever bit it was to kind of play. And
we were talking about how zany, right? We're sort of getting, this is very, like, if you saw this, when you, the moose conversation and the subtitles at the very, from the get-go, there's just this, it's not surreal. It's, I guess, just zany. It's just, what is going on? It's very metatextual.
I think of it as absurdist, really.
Absurdist to some extent. Yeah, I think that's, and I think this is kind of what I've been thinking about with this film is sometimes, I mean, these guys in Monty Python, these guys are as smart and as erudite as people come. And the comments that they're making, even about medievalism in this film, are very smart jokes. There's like 30% of this movie that's a hilarious, like, intellectual commentary on the Middle Ages and King Arthur, and 70% zany, so that it won't be boring to most people who really wouldn't be interested in jokes about medievalism, is kind of how I view this film.
Yeah, no, I think that one of them, or even two of them, were scholars in this area, or at least had some kind of study background in medieval. Was it Terry Jones?
I think it's Terry Jones, because he does a documentary series about the Middle Ages later in his life, and I think it's based on his own reading of things. And there's a lot of nods to things. So you watch it the first time, and the funny parts are, you know, the Bridge of Death, the guy not being able to remember his favorite color and flying into the, that's hilarious when you're a kid and you haven't seen it before, and the knight getting his arm cut off and saying, like, it's only a flesh wound and things like, you know, those are very funny the first time. But then when you watch it a couple more times, like, one of the funniest parts I always thought is the bit where he runs into that, like, political activist peasant. You know what I'm talking about?
The anarchist collective who's saying
an anarcho-syndicalist commune, which the funny thing, it's funny on the surface, but it's even funnier because you realize that's the way people were writing about the Middle Ages at this time in academic circles. There's all these people talking about, like, well, actually the feudal system wasn't this, it was actually a sort of proto-communist structure and blah blah blah, and they're putting these words into the mouths of peasants, you know. And the peasants, by the way, are consistently smarter than the knights, which is another commentary on medievalists always talk about, you know. Okay,
and yes and no, except when they're trying to figure out, you know, is the witch heavier than a
witch?
Right.
Right.
It's a duck, she's gonna be like a duck. What else floats on water? A duck.
I like that you brought up an anarcho-capitalist discussion in the field, because that's actually the, I think, the third scene in the movie, and it comes right before the first laugh scene with the Black Knight. So I think they're really conscious of how they're structuring the movie, layering the information in with the laughs. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally think so. You know, you don't want too much intellectual humor, because then the groundlings are going to get bored. So you got to do like a guy getting his head cut off scene, and somebody gets poop thrown in his face or something. And
yeah, this podcast struggles with that too.
Yes, definitely. No, actually, that 100%, that's why I was thinking about this, because I was thinking that it's hard to punch with both of those hands, right? You're like, on one hand, I get into, like, you know, analyzing the thing we're talking about and having fun with the intellectual level of whatever it is, but you also want to make a wiener joke every once in a while to keep people happy, you know, to keep yourself entertained and to keep other people entertained. So it's maybe a lesson in how we should handle things on the podcast. Perhaps we should lighten it up. I don't know, Bill, do you have gas? Could you interject?
why would I be the one with gas? I don't understand.
You're there. I see you. I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that to some extent, they definitely struggled with this a lot. I was just watching a documentary called Monty Python, Almost the Truth, The Lawyer's Cut.
Okay.
It's fascinating how they really did struggle. They decided to have two directors on this film. They, but the Terrys were both the, were both took over directing the film. And then it's interesting how they just sort of naturally fell into their roles, where you had Terry Gilliam, who had done most of the graphic art stuff, and that was kind of his background, right? Versus Terry Jones being like wanting to make sure that the scenes were all set up really well. So these guys, you know, they definitely struggled, and there was a lot of conflict even with the other actors who are in the film. Like, it wasn't all as like auto cohesive as we would have hoped. There was a lot of spontaneity and struggle.
Yeah, they're actually still kind of sparring with each other to this day.
They still have issues that will come up that they have to deal with, and why they can't always come together for certain reunions and certain events.
Oh, it's that bad, huh? They're like, they don't
it
want
used to be,
to be.
I think most of that bad blood is behind them. But I do know that I'd like to think it was, but I do know that there have been some events that just couldn't happen with all of them because, you know, one or two of them couldn't deal with another one. It's a shame, but like that kind of happens, you know, like conflict is sometimes part of the creative process, and especially when you're collaborating on something like that. And
so any collaboration, there's going to be conflict, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I can't see there being, it would be difficult, very difficult for it to be smooth, especially with, right, six, or is it seven of primary players in Monty Python, all of whom, like we said, really smart, creative, talented guys. They're going to butt heads. It's, you know, they seem to have gotten along pretty well.
Yeah.
Considering
the best anecdote I saw about this was one from Eric Idle. So George Harrison actually funded Life of Brian, and it would not have been made without him. And at one point, Eric Idle was complaining to George Harrison about how hard it was to be in a creative process with Michael Palin and John Cleese. And he was like, I feel like I can't get any words in edgewise.
And George Harrison might have known a little something,
right?
About that. Yeah.
He's like, well, try recording with Lennon and McCartney.
There you go. I mean, I think it's comparable in terms of the level of talent in the room for comedy. I think you're dealing with like Lennon and McCartney in the room, and then George Harrison is like the third best in the room, kind of thing. Like, that's how much talent there is here. And then I guess maybe Terry Gilliam would be Ringo. Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I want to get into that. Something like
he was
that.
He was the American coming in, right?
Yeah.
So he, you know, so he like went to Occidental versus all the others who were coming from like Cambridge and Oxford.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize. Well, maybe
he did
I
Time
should.
Bandits, and he did the Fisher King, and he did you know, like, he and the Fisher King too. Like, there is a little bit of a medieval under, you know, tied with that, you know.
Well, the Fisher King is an Arthur reference, yeah.
Yes, right.
It's the guy who guards. He's the guy who guards the Holy Grail. So theoretically, the guy in Indiana Jones, I guess, is the Fisher King. Although he's not really fishing in that, but
right.
We were actually just talking about this because it was in The Wasteland. The Fisher King makes an appearance in the poem The Wasteland because it's got an Arthurian theme to it. And so did Tortilla Flats, the Steinbeck book that we read. It's really weird how much Arthur has been coming up. Well, not necessarily recently, but on this podcast. So the George Harrison thing you're talking about, though, is actually something I wanted to talk about, because it's in this film. It was bankrolled by Led Zeppelin, Elton John, and
Pink Floyd.
Several other.
Yeah, there were eight.
Yeah.
Jethro Tull. Yeah. Together, I think the musicians bankrolled about 33% of the movie. So a third of the movie was done through that, which carries over into Spamalot earnings too, weirdly.
Well, the funny thing about that is that the reason why they did it is because they were in this like 90% tax bracket in the United Kingdom at the time. And so basically Elton John was like, why not spend my money on something like a movie? And it was almost like the producers. They were all basically planning on losing money on this film and ended up making like huge amounts of money because it ended up being fairly successful, I think, especially in the UK. But I think it had a decent earnings.
175,000-ish pounds to make.
Okay.
And it made $175 million. That's current earnings worldwide.
Okay. Well, yeah, all right. Yeah,
we're all that time. Over 50 years ago. So
yeah, sure.
You know, really so, anything else.
What year is the film? Is the film 1970?
75, I believe.
Five. Okay. So yeah, almost 50 years.
Is that 100 times the investment? My math is bad, but
It sounds like it. Yeah, if it's 170, about 175,000 to 175 million. Yeah, that's 1,000 times.
Except one of those numbers was pounds and the other one's in dollars.
Fair.
Yeah, so less so, but still.
Still, yeah. Wow. That's a success. I mean,
I'd say making back your money 500 fold is a success. Yeah. Not to mention just being involved in a project like this. I would put my money into that just to be able to say I had something to do with it. What's everybody's favorite sequence? And has it changed on repeat viewings?
I think it's probably changed from a teen to now in my late 40s. Castle Anthrax as a teenager was certainly entertaining and fun and voluptuous.
What is going on with the names of the girls in Castle Anthrax? What in the... Like, their names are Dingo, Zoot. They're just insane names. And I was thinking, is that a joke about
something? That's got to be some in-joke that's, you know, that might have been situational to the time, some reference to, I don't know. You're right. That is kind of weird.
I mean, almost everything I thought about in this film, I could think of something from medieval history that it's a joke about. I mean, there's so much in this. It's Life of Brian's kind of the same way. There's a lot of like Latin jokes and Roman Empire jokes and stuff like that. Like, I think several of them are historians and they're working from that. So
Cleese talks about in this documentary series that I've been watching about the group is going to a thesaurus one time, like writing a sketch and just trying to come up with as many different ways of saying like one, like death, right?
So, oh yeah. The parrot, like the parrot sketch.
The parrot sketch is exactly where that's coming from. Right. And so just using a thesaurus to write it out. Just one after another. And it turns out, so I think they do that often. And I think that their way of just
this
trying to.
This parrot is no longer.
It is no more.
He has shuffled up this mortal coil.
And snuffed it.
It's an ex-parrot.
Yeah, that is a good one, by the way. And that was one where they came up with a sort of basic idea for a sketch that wasn't funny. And the idea percolated with them for a long time before they finally figured out to do a parrot. It started out as a guy coming in talking about his toaster. Because I think it was John Cleese was like, we've got something here. There's something funny here, but we need to keep working on this. I guess what that says to me is it seems to me like some of this seems like it must just have been inspiration, right? Like, they're so zany and so surreal that some of it just seems like it must have been off the cuff, but it's not. It's just like everything else that we've talked about on the podcast, artistic and creative. You work on these things. Yeah. They don't just spring forth fully formed.
It's very rare that ad libbing. Yeah,
they even said with this, you know, with the Holy Grail is that, you know, when it first came out, they were getting no laughs. In early showings, yeah, they like first 5 minutes there was some laughter, and then the whole rest of the film was like a silent crowd.
Wow, that's right? Weird.
Which is crazy to think about that. And so like 13 variations and 13 different drafts to.
So they actually rewrote some stuff in response to that.
They rewrote a huge majority. No, that was by far not.
Do you know how many jokes are in this film?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah. Give me an estimate. I want to hear from the experts here.
I'm still trying to think what scene I thought was funniest, but okay.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We can go back to that.
Let's say 172. And when I was a kid, my favorite thing was the killer rabbit. And I.
Yes, absolutely. When I was a little kid, I loved that. My kids liked that too when we watched it. So.
My favorite as a kid and favorite now still is Black Knight and that duel.
A good one.
It hasn't changed too much. I do like the deeper understanding of the scene with the peasant talking about, you know, the political. Uh-huh. That resonated when you said that about the depth. But yeah, and I'll go.
You want to hear the deepest thing about that? Or anyway, to me anyway, what I learned about that sequence is I'm trying to remember which one it is. I think it's Michael Palin. He's talking to the one guy first, Dennis, right? And Dennis's wife is like crawling along and she's like, Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here.
Muck.
there's a character in John Bunyan, right? In Pilgrim's Progress called the Muckraker, who's so focused on the muck that he doesn't look up above and see the rest of the world because he's working so hard in the filth. So that joke, which is like a throwaway, fairly funny joke, is based on something that's like a great reference. It's a little bit like T.S. Eliot. You're like, oh, this is a great line of a poem, but it's also this amazing allusion to something. I don't know. I'd love that. I love that kind of thing.
That's really smart. I had no idea. Thank you.
I thought that was really neat, but Help, I'm being
help,
oppressed.
Help,
I'm being come see the violence inheritance system. Yeah, no, that's a really good bit. I really appreciate that. But definitely my favorite when I was a kid, I'm on board with Chris, it was the rabbit. I had never seen anything that made me laugh that hard in my life when I was, I don't know, I was probably 9 when I saw this the first time, and I was just like, what is happening right now? But again, did I tell you guys about this before? But that's a reference to something.
You there mentioned used to be, this, the rabbit being
these,
in the...
Yeah, there were these medieval bestiary manuscripts that showed rabbits in combat, like dressed like people. Something that actually comes from the 1300s is not even something, you know, modern or anything. So I'm guessing they knew about it, and that was a reference to that too. Which again,
I wish Paul
just...
was here for this, because he was talking about maybe it's a polymorphed dragon that
yeah. Yeah, for those of you who are not in the know, a polymorph spell is when you know, when a witch turns you into a newt, that is a polymorph spell. So polymorphing is part of the canon of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, apparently, because the one guy does get turned into a newt.
Right.
Which, right. Which got better.
I mean, got he got better. Better. Yeah.
But he got better. Yeah.
Yes.
So I've got 127 jokes as an estimate from Chris. Kevin, what do you got?
Yeah, I was going to go for like...
I thought I had 172, but okay.
Those numbers do actually appear in the answer is why I inverted them. So
I was going to go with, 150 something. 154.
Okay.
Let's go with 154.
You guys are in the same general area. Okay, Bill?
Well, now that I know it's a shift of those three numbers, I'm going to have to go with 712.
It's not a shift of all three numbers. Sorry, I'm misleading.
Oh,
it just does include 27. Right. 27 is part of the answer.
All right, then 721. No.
According to the creators of the film, there are 527 individual jokes in this movie. And as I heard that, and as I was watching the movie, I was like, well, what counts as a joke, right? You sort of. The coding of that data is gonna influence what counts, but there's a lot of jokes
stuff happening in the background. I mean, the Camelot song in and of itself, there's a joke every other second. I mean, it's
right. Yep. Or you know, just everything that anybody says being a reference to something else. Does anybody say anything in this film that is not a joke? Is there a line of dialogue that is just a line of dialogue?
I am Arthur, King of the Britons.
One of the things I always liked is how when something bad happens and Arthur just goes, Jesus Christ.
He does that about 3 times in the movie.
He's paragon of Christianity, and he's like just at the drop of a hat yelling, Jesus Christ.
And he doesn't do that. Like, that's not like something that they do in any other movie. Like, that is something that Arthur does in this movie only. It's not like it's a Graham Chapman thing that he does.
It's very deliberate. Yeah.
Yes, oh, it's deliberate. Yes, yeah.
It's deliberate. It's, right. Again,
you just talk to God and now I'm going to do that. Yeah.
But, oh, that's one of the things I laughed at the hardest when watching it this time is when they're talking to God.
I'm averting my eyes, yeah.
You know, God's like, you know, stop groveling. I hate groveling. And then he's like, no, I want you to do this. And he's like, good idea, Lord. And he's like, of course it's a good idea. Like, you just told God that was a good idea. You know, I mean, of course it's God you're talking to. Every time I know every line, but for some reason, each time I watch it, something different hits me as the funniest moment of the movie. Maybe just because of where I am.
Yeah,
I have to say, this time around, the part that made me laugh the most was the end of The Knights Who Say Knee. Just all the side conversations going on. You know, like, they totally start ignoring them, and they start saying it over and over, and the knights are...
Oh, yeah.
I did it again!
No! I did it again! Yep. That's, I think, a joke about the spell Power Word Kill, right?
Clearly a reference.
We're going deep in the weeds now.
Exactly. But this is the Dork Weekend 9 themes podcast episode, so I think we have to have some dork content.
It's fair.
I guess for those of you who maybe don't know what I mean by Dork Weekend, it's when we all get together and play D&D for like 3 or 4 days, which we
each have a tradition. We'd meet yearly, and the pandemic kind of took that away from us, and this was our first Dork.
Literally, we had a house booked in New Mexico for Dork Weekend.
It was an awesome house, too. We had a telescope.
Yeah, I was going to be out in New Mexico, and then, you know, the pandemic happened, and I moved out of New Mexico. Global events, that's just the way it goes.
Well, thank goodness we just all didn't have too much of each other 2 weeks ago.
No, it wasn't too bad. It's pretty. I got a little tired of running the game, I have to say. After, not tired, like I didn't like it, but I was a shell of myself. But
dude,
by the
power,
time we,
like doing 3 days straight of running a game is that's taxing.
We went out to dinner. I think it's the third night of Dork Weekend. We went out to dinner at a Mexican place, and I got a great big margarita and had some chips, and I didn't have to like decide what range a longbow can shoot for a couple of minutes. And I was like, oh, I'm in heaven right now. This is really pleasant. Like just sitting back
on vacation
here.
Now.
Yeah. The vacation I had was, it was great. I mean, the whole thing was great, but I hung out with you guys. So first of all, I drove to Orlando from New York City. Then I ran a game for like 3 straight days, which was a blast, but also not chill. And then I took my kids to Disney World for a couple of days right after that. So it was like a hodgepodge of ways you could be on vacation, but not be on vacation, basically, like the whole thing. And then I drove all the way back from Orlando, by the way, at the end of that, like at the end of the trip.
Let me say something that's kind of painfully obvious, but I'll kick myself if I don't mention it.
Okay.
One of the things I really appreciate about this movie is how they plan around the low budgetness of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Know that they use coconuts instead of horses, but they're doing it because they don't want to pay for the horses.
Because they didn't want to pay for horses. They really made, what's the word? Like lemonade out of lemons.
Very much. Yeah.
They didn't know how to pay at the end. They were supposed to have a great big battle and they didn't know how to pay for it. So they just had everybody get arrested.
Which was
hilarious.
Leading up to it to give it some heat in. They didn't want to have the scenes for Camelot. So they just showed a model of it and had
a model
number and moved on. So
and then the guy says it's only a model.
Yes.
In the animation, of course, right? Yes. That mm-hmm. sure was cheaper. When you have an animator on staff who could do the animation, that also probably helped with the budget.
What do you guys think of the animation? Could you cut the animation and not really miss it?
I don't think so, because it ties certain scenes together.
See where the sun and the moon are jumping up and down and saying.
Not so much, but the beast that gets chased where the animator has
yes,
a heart.
Yes, that's attack, part of it. Yeah, that's part of it.
Right. Explaining why you never see Robin's minstrels again, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Actually, you know what?
And you wouldn't have got.
Okay, yes. Well, those parts are funny. Those parts. But I always kind of thought like that there's a couple of goofy, you know, illuminated manuscript looking scenes in the middle where I was like, I could do without this. I don't really. Something about the way that the animation on Monty Python looked, I think old animation depressed me when I was a kid. I used to hate Rocky and Bullwinkle. Rocky and Bullwinkle would come on TV and it looked all grainy and crappy. And for some reason, I would just be like, oh my God, like, you know, I don't know why it just upset me. I wanted bright colors. I wanted to see the way Masters of the Universe looked on TV when I was a kid. That's what I wanted to see. I wanted just color in my face. Like,
but I totally understand why they did it though, because you needed, because they're all a bunch of skits and you needed some interstitial thing.
Connective tissue. Yeah, basically.
You know, you were saying earlier how impressive their knowledge of medieval history is. Mm-hmm. Equally impressive is their knowledge of how to craft a joke and bring things together. I don't think I've ever seen a movie that is more obsessed with the rule of three in comedy than this movie. You see it all the way through. Everything's in threes. Three is a big number all the way through. There are
and then
taunting scenes that the French do. Right.
But in a very metatextual way, that becomes a joke in the movie several times where he can't count to three.
Yes.
He's five. Which is another
five.
Joke.
One,
on
two, the five.
Yeah. One, two, five, three.
Five
oh,
is
oh, yes.
Right out.
Yeah, like, but which is another, which I think is kind of a reference to the supposed illiteracy of Charlemagne also. I don't
know. Well, I guess it's also kind of a reference to King Arthur being the only one that's not funny.
Yeah.
He is the straight man of the movie.
Jesus Christ.
Pretty much. Well, Lancelot has some silliness to him. And I don't know, the knights themselves are usually played pretty straight. There's Sir Robin is a ridiculous coward, which is a funny bit.
Okay, we have to make a joke about Lancelot being straight. The end of the Cathal Anthrax. Are you gay? And then Camelot, he comes out.
Hey, you're gay. I'm not.
Which is weird because, according to the myth, wasn't it Lancelot who betrayed?
Interesting that Guinevere does not appear in this movie, nor does Morgan Le Fay or Merlin.
Well, isn't Tim sort of supposed to be a Merlin?
But you're right.
No,
they call him Merlin.
Merlin.
Not like it's copyright. They called him Tim because they thought it was funny, I guess.
Or maybe it's funny that they just don't say it. You know that.
Right,
that...
you're subverting expectations there. I am Tim.
There are those who would call me Tim.
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 No, I think the Bridge of Death, I forgot. That's probably one of the bits I thought was funniest when I was a kid, too. Like, I used to, the first time I saw it, for some reason, the whole dialogue of it stuck in my head, and I used to run it over and over again. Because maybe it's like what you're saying with the rule of three, it's just so well crafted on a very basic joke crafting level. The first guy asks the question, and it's easy. And he's like, oh, okay. And he goes up, and then the next guy gets a really hard question. And he doesn't know what the capital of Assyria is. It's Nineveh, by the way. And he gets thrown into a pit and dies. And then the next guy goes and he gets it's easy again, but then he forgets what his favorite color is and dies. It's stupid. Like, it's really not that funny, like, but it's just well crafted, like you said. It's just well written.
I feel like that's a joke in and of itself too, because they don't use the rule of three there. It's three questions, but four people get asked the questions. Because Arthur goes after the guy you're talking about.
Oh, right. Because then he does the swallow thing. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
I don't know
okay,
that.
Another really fun question. What scene is the only one that has a horse in it? You guys all just watch this movie. I'll give you a moment.
Oh, when the dead, bring out your dead with the cart, probably.
Is it with the...
Oh, it's when the historian gets killed.
Yes.
Oh.
Historian gets killed by a man on the horse, which, yeah, incidentally, is also a joke because no one in the movie rides a horse.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't kill the story.
Yeah, that's funny. So who killed him? Yeah, that's a good... Yeah, you're right. There's also another thing. I was actually thinking about that same scene, the other joke in that. It's the idea, the historian, he's giving this very dry lecture about what's going on in the story when he gets killed, right? During that scene, he's like, Arthur being very disappointed by blah, blah, blah. And then like, he runs into an actual knight. Like, he's been studying this his entire life, but when he runs into an actual knight, it's a murderous thug that just splits his head open and kills him, because actually knights are pieces of crap that murder people all the time, you know? There's a joke in that, too. I mean, I don't know. It's really, the jokes of that stuff, it's very multi-layered, and I think that's why I would watch it over and over again. It's funny. It's funny. And also, I think things in a British accent are a little funnier on some level, because
selling to Americans.
to Americans, because I think on some level we're almost translating a little bit, so there's a little bit of a remove from the humor, or maybe it just sounds funny. I remember saying things when I was in England just in my regular voice and people just dying laughing at what I said. It was just my way of talking. I wasn't even making a joke, really.
And that happens probably the other way around.
I think it happens, yeah, when you're sort of at a remove.
Yes.
I have this other theory about comedy that I think we've talked about this before, that comedians are often outsiders in some way, like a little bit of an other, not like a total other, but you know, there's comedians, there's like African-American comedians like Eddie Murphy. And sort of what's funny is that he talks a little bit different than I do. And so his intonation and his cadence is a little different. Like British people, same thing. It's like, it sounds a little different. So it just hits me funnier. It just hits me a little obliquely compared to an American guy just talking. That's a theory. I think there's
a meter of the delivery for Monty Python in general, but certainly it's very, you know, surfaced in this, where there is a meter to a lot of the humor that they keep going, and they know when to keep going. And then, you know, like there's the sudden drop, and then you have the expectation that they're going to keep going, and then they don't. You know, it's they play with that expectation. They set up the, like, as you were saying, Chris, like they set up these rules sometimes to break them later, to kind of bring, because part of humor too is an abrupt shock, you know, or, you know, the upturn of an expectation, right?
Yeah.
Or the unexpected, right. They are truly masters of comedy, and it really comes through. And,
There are a few that really show. The part where he's giving the orders to the guards to watch his son and keep him from leaving the room.
Just keeps going. Yeah. But it still works, I think. I think it's still kind of funny.
The whole scene where he keeps accidentally killing people. And
yeah.
With the wedding scene. And just, oh, no, can't. Well, he's dead. And, you know, it. That constant... Yes,
or the running gag of I'm not dead yet, that comes up, I don't know, four or five times
not
throughout
dead
the film
yet.
That's pretty fun. That's a funny bit, you know. There's the bit where the porter gets hit with the arrow,
yeah,
you know, and he's like, message for you, sir, like falls over. It's like message. I was thinking in the old days with Macintosh computers, and you'd get the little notifications that you could take something from a movie and use it. That would be a great one for an email coming in. Message for you, sir. Like,
anyway. Instead of you've got mail, if they had just used message for you.
Squawk.
You could easily take a clip of that and turn that into a audio clip to have on your phone.
We've all seen this before, so this segment that we always do is going to be a little probably about the research, I'm guessing. In my case, this is about the research. But what was everybody's biggest surprise about Monty Python and the Holy Grail on the 647th viewing?
The funding. I had
that was pretty good.
Sorry, I know I stole that from you, Chris, probably. I could just tell by the look on your face.
We're all learning things. We've all learned so much about this movie. It's good.
I did not realize the organization behind making this thing a reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good surprise. I thought about that one too. I did find another piece of another something. So Chris, is your surprise stolen?
You know what? I'm agile. I'll stay on my feet.
Oh, nice. I like it.
That my biggest surprise is I think I like And Now for Something Completely Different better than this movie.
Oh, interesting.
It's just something completely different that makes me laugh start to finish every time.
There are parts of Life of Brian that I think are funnier than this. Overall, I think I enjoyed this movie better, but there's the joke where he's graffitiing on the wall in Latin and the Roman soldier comes up and corrects him on his Latin is one of the funniest things. But that's just me as like a language nerd. I love that sequence. But
no, you have the parrot, the Ministry of Silly Walks, Mr. Creosote. I think those are all in something completely different.
But aren't they from the show too? They're from Flying Circus, like they were on the original show, or were they?
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I love the absurdist humor element of Monty Python, and I think it's just more on display in that movie. Mm. It put this movie down.
Okay. I kind of think that's almost like a different thing, though. You know, like your Meaning of Life, Life of Brian, and Monty Python on Holy Grail are films that have a narrative. You know, I feel like that one's kind of like a best of. Almost like the best of from the sketch show. But yeah, I think some of those things are funnier. The parrot sketch is one of the funniest things anybody's ever written. I mean, that's still funny like 50 years later, but
that's who's on first level.
Yes, exactly. Who's on first? I think, I don't know if it's like laugh out loud funny 100 years later, but it's still well written. You're watching and you're like, this is funny. You maybe don't actually laugh, but it's very well written. All right, Bill, anything surprise you?
Yeah, you know, the number of clips from this that were on a CD set that I had called The Final Ripoff. There were a lot more from this. I thought that I had thought for a long time that the majority of that content, those clips, had come out of Flying Circus.
But most of it's from Holy Grail, huh?
There were a lot more from Holy Grail than I thought there were.
How are you just discovering this now? I mean, hadn't you seen this movie 500 times before? And
I mean, it's been a while. I can't tell you how long it's been, but
I hadn't seen it since probably not long after college, and then I showed it to my kids about 4 years ago. So I had seen it fairly recently, but otherwise, not brave enough to keep going with the hand grenades, huh? Too worried about shrapnel in your liver?
I think if I had another hand grenade, I might die.
Nice. Yeah, well, that's what I was saying. Too much ecto cooler will make you actually a ghost, so you have to be careful. My biggest surprise, and I thought about the rock star thing. I thought that was a great fact, but I also kind of suspected somebody might choose it, so I went a little deeper. An interesting thing, so Monty Python and it's Flying Circus. Monty Python was not on TV in the United States, obviously, like when it first came out. What ended up happening was a local PBS affiliate in Dallas, Texas, got a hold of these tapes and started playing it on PBS, and it spread on PBS, and they started playing Monty Python on PBS all over the country because of it. So what was really interesting about that, though, is, do you know who was in charge of that local PBS affiliate in Dallas, Texas? Luke and Owen Wilson's dad was the guy who brought Monty Python to the United States of America. I thought that was a pretty cool surprise. That's got to be the coolest person in Dallas, right? It's not a super cool town, like, overall. Like,
AR was pretty cool, right?
Yeah, he's fictional, you might note.
I was just going to say that the reason that it hadn't come to the U.S., hadn't come to PBS, is because it was a completely different
It was something format. Completely different.
It was now for something completely different. It's a completely different format to the film process between the UK and the US. And so the cost of reformatting it to the United States format norm was too expensive.
You mean like in a technical sense?
The technical component, the technical part of it was too expensive to actually reformat it to, it's like NSTC or something like that.
We talked about this before, but it's the 1970s doesn't seem that long ago in some ways in terms of technology. But do you remember we talked about the Doctor Who episode that had disappeared and was only existed on a tape in one place in Nigeria or something like that?
Yeah. Entire seasons of Doctor Who have fallen down the rabbit hole.
Oh, really? Oh, I thought it was just one episode.
They found, I think, an entire season in Zimbabwe, I think, of all places.
Yeah, I think that's the story I'm talking about, because it's strange to think, but, you know, you had to physically send something to a place like, you know, Southern Africa if you wanted to put it on TV there. This podcast is literally going to get dropped on Podbean and will be available all over the earth in exactly the format that we recorded it, which is nuts. And it happens. I look at the map, they show me on Podbean, like people downloading the show, like literally all over the planet, which is, you know, we take that for granted today, but that's nuts. I don't even know if we should bother voting.
If anyone in Zimbabwe is downloading this, please just look under the bed sheets for another season of Doctor Who. There are a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, sub-Saharan Africa is not one of our most popular, not the place where we get the most downloads. There's a handful. There's like, I think I saw one someplace odd, like Mozambique. You would think South Africa, right? But there was one in Mozambique, the Cote d'Ivoire, because we actually know a guy who lived in Cote d'Ivoire for a while, and I'm pretty sure it was him downloading it there. But anyway, there's a couple of countries in Africa where we have downloads, but not a lot. So, shall we go through the voting process? This seems kind of like Vladimir Putin being up for election, though. I mean, I think we're going to get, the returns are going to be overwhelming in favor of this being. Does anybody want to make the case?
Except kill a bunch of people at Kiva, but.
Does anybody want to make the case that this does not, that we should not toast this classic? Does anybody want to speak up against the dictator here?
Honestly, the most controversial thing I would have to say is it's not my favorite Monty Python.
It's not your favorite Monty Python. Now, that would be a more interesting discussion, and I have not watched the other films recently to be able to judge. I think this is my favorite. This is the one I watched 100 times. I mean, this one, I think, was my favorite. To some extent, you could say that the show, Flying Circus, was more important, but I don't know. This is pretty darn good. This gets referenced in so many things.
Would you consider Flying Circus to be more important in retrospect after the movies and everything else came out? Like, I would say this is their pinnacle. You know, like, this is it. When you think Monty Python, it's the Holy Grail.
I think so. Yeah, definitely. The one thing I noticed, though, is it's like the style of humor, right? The only thing I've ever seen that's like it, and I don't know if you guys have ever, when we talked about George Harrison earlier, but the Beatles films, especially the movie Help, is this exact same style of humor. And it's really funny, actually. And it's like, I would say 1967 it must have been for it to be Help, maybe even earlier. So it's a good 10 years before this almost. And if you like this kind of humor, I would recommend going and watching that. It's very similar. It's got surrealistic elements, British accents, saying things in ways that just make them funnier than they otherwise would be. And I don't know. I thought that was really funny too. So I think this was not entirely just the Pythons that had the sense of humor, I guess is what I'm saying. A little bit of the British zeitgeist at the time.
I fairly recently had someone from Australia tell me I had a decidedly mid-American accent. And I wasn't sure whether that was a compliment or not.
In my experience, if anybody comments on you being American, they don't mean it as a compliment. They just inherently think that we're inferior and are the butt of jokes. I think we grew up in the Northern Virginia area, Chris and I, and I think we do have what would be considered a neutral middle American accent, even though we're technically in the South or in the East Coast. I mean, it'd be one of those things, but DC doesn't have an accent, at least not white DC residents don't have an accent, but like, we don't sound like anything. Nobody's ever said to me, oh, you must be from DC.
Well, when I'm in Richmond, I'm told that I have a Northern Virginia accent. And when I'm in New Jersey... Well,
they just mean you don't have a Southern accent.
Well, but when I'm in New Jersey, I'm told that I have a Southern accent. And I'm like, what are y'all talking about? You know, but...
what are y'all talking about?
What are y'all talking about? Yeah?
No, there's a mid-Atlantic accent that you hear, and to me it's more prominent in Baltimore, but occasionally I meet people in the DC area that I can tell have lived there for a long time because they have it. And the thing you hear the most is the long O sound is nasalized. It's like O. Mm-hmm. You hear somebody say O.
It's definitely Baltimore, yeah.
That's Baltimore, but if you listen, you'll hear people from you will hear people, especially blue collar people from Northern Virginia who have that. Like that's the accent.
Do you hear people say Washington?
My grandfather used to say that, but he was from Indiana.
Okay.
I thought that's where he picked that up. I don't know. I don't know whether that's a local thing or what, but let's go ahead. Let's vote. Kevin.
Oh, classic. No question. Classic.
No caveats. No.
No caveats. No question. I went into this maybe biased, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I went into it biased, but I thoroughly enjoyed watching the movie again.
Yes.
I mean, that's a big, and I showed it to my kids and they liked it. A grainy old 50-year-old movie, and the kids sat and enjoyed
still
it.
Like, wow.
I mean, that's a good movie.
That says it all to me.
I can understand why kids like it.
Yeah, well, that's it because it hits with both hands, right? It's got these zany things like a rabbit eating people, but it's also got nerdy medieval jokes. So, like, dad's happy, the kids are happy. Bill?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Well
yes.
Said.
You know, I really enjoyed doing more of the history on this and learning more about kind of where some of the roots as to how Monty Python came to be. I thought was really fascinating learning more about them, learning about, like, there was a lot of old radio stuff that they had listened to that they were taking a lot of their history from in terms of their style. There was a group, it was called the Goon Squad is an old radio show. The UK at post World War II kind of didn't have a whole lot of television. It was mostly radio.
Post World War II in the United States, it was mostly radio. I mean, people didn't really start getting TV into the 50s. It had been invented, but it was like in war games, you know how the guys got the internet? But like nobody else has the internet
nobody
for
else
12
has
years,
internet.
You know,
right,
like I
right.
didn't even know the internet existed, even though I'd seen War Games. If you'd asked me, what is the internet? I would have been like, I don't know. I've never heard of that. But
here in the U.S. and there abroad, there were people were sitting around a radio listening to these comedy sketches as kind of a mainstay.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I was thinking about the British sense of humor that's kind of in this. Maybe goes back even as far as Gilbert and Sullivan. Right, they're kind of like goofy yet also smart at the same time sense of humor, but I don't know. I'm not actually, that'd be a good thing to do for the show, by the way, because I don't know Gilbert and Sullivan at all. I've been hearing about it my whole life. So it looks like we are authenticating this, validating it, and calling it a classic. Is that right? Am I hearing that? Are we unanimous? Okay.
Yeah.
We've got what, three podcasters here today on the show? Is it one, two? It's either four or five. No, five is right out. No, it's four. We have four podcasters on the show today. So everybody has agreed that Monty Python and the Holy Grail is a classic. This is David MacArthur. I'm saying goodbye.
Thank you all. It's been Chris.
Peace out, Bill.
I'm gone.
Gentlemen.
All right, guys. Peace out.
That's it for episode 95 of Toasting the Classics. For those playing along at home, get some beer in brown bottles for our discussion of Johnny Cash's album at Folsom Prison. Slight spoiler alert, you might want to listen to his San Quentin album as well. If you'd like to get in touch, please send us an email at toastingtheclassics@gmail.com. Send us show ideas, comments, complaints, and let us know your favorite Python. Mine is Burmese. Check out my blog at theattractivenuisance.com and follow us on Twitter at @reactivenuisance. Our music was written by Michelle MacArthur. See you next time on Toasting the Classics.